Porrick, a lot of people will have heard of the Battle of the Boyne, and many people, but not so many, will have heard of the Battle of Ockram. Can you explain how, after the Battle of the Boyne, the Battle of Ockram came about?
Well, the Battle of the Boyne was not decisive in the sense it didn't end the war. The Battle of the Boyne happens in year two of a three-year war. So the third year, the winter of 1690 into the spring and early summer of 1691, the Irish controlled, or the Jacobites still controlled, all of Connacht, maybe about 15, 20 miles of a no-man's land on the Leinster side of, and Munster side of the Shannon River, and Kerry as well. So right, got a territorially strong, contiguous block. They have good help from France. The French are beginning to wake up to the importance of the Irish War as a diversion for William of Orange, William III, the linchpin of the anti-French alliance. So they're supporting the Irish with material, weapons and supplies. Literally, the Irish army is eating hand to mouth by food sent by French. So it lasts until the following year because the Irish, if you like, have this strong defensive position. And Ockram happens after that line is broken. It's broken at Athlone, where William, having gone home, he leaves Dutch General Goddard, von Reed, Baron de Ginkel, and he manages to, as it were, bulldoze his way eventually, using massive artillery firepower, the largest scale of expenditure that had been seen in Ireland before then, pushes his way across the Shannon at Athlone. The Jacobites, now led by a Frenchman, a French general, Saint-Roch was beside himself. He was smarting with embarrassment over the fact that he had lost that loan. It was, in many respects, down to his mistakes that he had made. So he wants to have a showdown, and he chooses Ockram, a reasonably good defensive position, rather than follow the advice of others, which was split the army, send half into Galway, half the infantry into Limerick, leave most of the cavalry and some of the infantry to wage a sort of a mobile guerrilla type campaign, which had proved that response had proved quite effective in the last phases of the Cromwellian conquest back in 1651-52, and it might have worked then. In other words, don't face them, don't wait for them, and cut off their supplies, raid their supply lines from Dublin, from the ports. Those are the options. This is why the battle is happening. Saint-Roch is the man in charge. He says, no, we're going to pull ourselves together after Athlone. We're going to wait for these guys at Ockram. We talk about Ockram as, it's really a small village, a hamlet, a couple of a miserable little hamlet, as one poet puts it, near a hill, a long hill, Kilcommodan Ridge, running north-south. That's probably the Ockram or Horse's Back. It's got a kind of a horseback shape to it. Jacobites, the Irish, are on that, on the battle lines, about 1.5 miles long. There's a bog in front of them, and the Williamites, as it were, the allies under Ginkel, are coming from the, or Hinkle, I think it's properly pronounced, they're coming from the direction of the east, from Athlone via Ballinasloe, and the Irish are waiting for them.
When we think about a battle today, like, say, I don't know, the Battle of the Bulge, the armies aren't lined up opposite each other. You know, there's skirmishes really that go on for miles and miles. But in those days, they really did line up face to face pretty much. Can you explain how that worked at Ockram?
Yeah, it's a fairly simple battle in that respect. Unlike the Boyne, which happens over a much wider area, and there are envelopments and countermarches. Here it's fairly simple. You have two lines. Well, you have a number. Each army is disposed in the battle lines. But imagine they're in one line. They're lines facing each other. It's called a parallel order battle. They're facing each other, not beyond musket shot, well beyond musket shot. And the Jacobites are on one ridge. There's a bog. And by bog, I mean not necessarily a turf bog. I'm using this contemporary term, bog, or a soft place, wet ground, marshy ground or morass. And on the other side, on reasonably high ground, are the Williamites. So they're looking at each other. That's the way. That's not unusual. And then the battle evolves. Hinkle is not a particularly subtle tactical or strategic thinker. He sends his cavalry to the south, or to the right of the Jacobite wing. if you can imagine both lines are rolling north-south facing each other. So Hinkle sends his southern extremity against the Jacobite southern wing to attack them on what he conceives to be their weakest point. The large-scale cavalry clash, the cavalry commander in that sector is the famous Patrick Sarsfield, and the Williamite attack is stopped dead. Right, that's it. So that, if you like, attempt at a localized attack fails. And contrary to what is represented as having happened after the battle by the Allies, what actually happened, or what Hinkle actually proposes and tries to implement thereafter, is a very brutally simple. Everybody attacks everywhere at the same time. Do you follow me? In other words, his entire line moves as parallel as possible and pushes against the Irish. That was his plan. Didn't happen like that, because the middle of his line got there first. They attacked on their own. They seemed to break through. They were surrounded, very badly mauled, driven back across the bog. Hinkle now looks, has, if you like, his battle line is a big hole in the middle. The southern section is stopped. There's a hole in the middle and we're at the northern section. And it's the attack in the northern section works. It delivers the day.
Say I was up on the hill at Ockram and I was with the Jacobite infantry. What would they have looked like? What kind of appearance would they have had?
By this stage of the war, they're getting more reliable supplies from the French than would have heretofore been the case at the earlier phase of the war. So most of them would have had shoes, right? We've said that earlier. Most of them would have had coats. So they would have had uniforms of a sort, right? They would be uniformly dressed. And this is a paradox as well. They're wearing red coats. They're the king's soldiers. Uh-huh. As are many of the troops, the English troops and the Scottish troops on the other side.
So they're both wearing red coats?
They're red coats. There are some variations within that, but the basic colour scheme on both sides is red, right? Remember, in a real sense, this is a civil war. This is war between two elements of the same polity of two within three kingdoms, three Stuart kingdoms.
There's the Allied soldiers and the Jacobites both wearing red coats. If I was a Jacobite soldier, what kind of weapon would I have been carrying and how would I have been fighting?
Well, one thing you might bear in mind if you're a Jacobite soldier is that you haven't eaten for 3 days. The Irish army was at the end, it had run out of, not so much small supplies, but it had run out of carriage to bring supplies. So morale might be a bit low on that account. What weapons would you have carried? Typically, you would still have a pike. Some of them would have pikes. Most would have had the old-fashioned matchlock muskets. So to some extent, the Irish army is following the older 17th century pattern of the pike-shot combination, whereas on the Allied side, they're 100% firepower, and most of them are using the more modern flintlock musket, which is less mechanically unreliable. It's still quite unreliable, but it's not as unreliable as the matchlock, and it's faster to reload. So those are the, if you like, differences in weapons. And that reflects a wider preference. The French tended to put greater trust in what they call steel, in bayonet or sword. Now, bayonet was a newfangled idea. The idea was basically the kind of bayonet they have in the 1690s is a plug bayonet. It's a knife with a shaped handle that you jam into the top of the, or the muzzle of your musket when you want to fight. So it combines, as it were, it turns your musket into a pike or into a stabbing weapon for those purposes. The Irish tend to have, as I say, not so much a bayonet. They follow French practice in preferring cold steel, quick charge, rather than a prolonged exchange of fire, and using the blade weapons or stabbing weapons as the decisive weapons in conflict. The Allies, on the other hand, perfect platoon firing and other systems of firing whereby they can deliver reliably volumes of firepower on the battlefield. Now, that's the future. The Allies are on the way of the future, as it were. And really, that older way of fighting, the Jacobite Battle of Culloden, which is 1746, and the so-called Highland Charge, that's really the last time where we see that kind of fighting taking place. Remember as well, all of this is happening in a pall, dense smoke, which reduces visibility or reduces the effectiveness of firepower.
Do you think that increases the terror factor that people can't really see what's going on?
Yes. Oddly enough, if an army breaks, or when armies break, the breaking happens not from the front ranks. It begins with the back ranks. It begins with people who can't see what's going on, but can hear what's going on. And that kind of unease happens at the rear ranks first. They break, they scatter, and then suddenly the fellows in the front rank find that there's nobody behind them, which itself is a very unsettling feeling. Mm. So, yes, I think imagination magnifies fears when you can't see something or you're not experiencing it directly.
Yeah. You know, if you see the footage of, for example, the war in Afghanistan, soldiers are blazing away at a great rate, they're blasting away. I mean, that wasn't open to a soldier in the 17th century battlefield. Would that have made them feel more afraid? I'd imagine it would.
You fire and reload very slowly. You may be firing volley fire initially, but it'll break down to individual fire at will. You have a limited amount of ammunition. At most, you're going to have a dozen shots, really. That question of blazing away for psychological comfort, which a lot of times is what they call suppressing fire. Yeah.
Mm.
Firmness.